Let's hop on board the telephone line and welcome in our friend Steve Buckley of The Athletic. Buck, good afternoon to you.
You know, I read your tweet a while back with one eye open, and for a split second, I thought that I was being invited on to talk about my Frank Sinatra memories. So I'll be more diligent moving forward reading your tweet.
What are your Sinatra memories, Buck?
Well, I actually do have one. Is I covered the Yankees for a couple of years, and I think they still do it, but they would play Sinatra's New York, New York after every Yankees game. And I have, to this day, when I hear that song, I'm instantly transported to the 1980s in the old stadium, the old new stadium. And it was really cool to see, to hear that song rocketing around that beautiful old stadium when the game was over, and the fans leaving and the players congratulating. And I caught the end of Billy Martin and Willie Randolph, and Guidry was still there. So it's a pleasant memory for me.
Nice. And now, is that better than Dirty Water or whatever at the end of Red Sox games?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. And they both bespeak their town, if you will. And so I think there's a nice parallel. Nothing against the Red Sox and their music choices, but Sinatra from Hoboken singing New York, New York, and he was a big baseball fan, and you know, used to go to Twin Shores with Jackie Gleason and that crowd. That's a cool thing they do there. I like that.
Absolutely, yeah, it's tough to stand up to that. Well, let's see where to begin. We'll come back and talk baseball in a bit, but Celtics gearing up for Game 6 tonight. You wrote about their, well, I thought you summed up their performance in one word: lethargic.
Yeah, it was pretty disappointing, and I did another interview, not to name drop, but I did a thing with Dan Patrick yesterday, and I said something that as soon as I said it, I said, God, I wish I'd used it in the column. At the very end of my column in The Athletic, I wrote that Tatum said something along the lines of, it just wasn't our day today, and it just seemed very, as I put it, shruggy and dismissive. And I closed the column by saying, I can't imagine any Celtic fan in the building that night walking out of there out in the Causeway Street saying, oh, it just wasn't our day. What I should have wrote and what I said on Dan Patrick, and I now share with Bangor, is that I can't imagine Kevin Garnett ever saying something like that after a playoff loss.
Yeah.
And to me, that bespeaks what the Celtics seemed. If you want to get all caught up in post-game porridge, that seemed to sum up the somewhat indifference that was on display after that game the other night.
So is that unique to the Celtics group, or is that the mindset of today's NBA player?
It's an excellent question that I posed to a friend this morning, that, you know, maybe I'm skating my old guy wing here, and that's just the way it is now. And maybe a sports psychologist would say, well, that's a necessary thing to sort of put that in the past and move forward. I suppose we could have that discussion from now until tip-off tonight, but I would have liked to see a little anger. It's not a bad thing, and I wished that maybe they could have shared what I assumed were the feelings of the people who follow the team. I mean, like, I know it was just from my own conversations, and Lord knows they got booed pretty heartily after that game and during that game the other night.
Well, yeah, and you wrote about the booing. Have they lost some of the fans? Are there some fans that are secretly hoping they get taken out, and maybe that leads to some roster moves? No,
I doubt that. I think that and this is where I do agree with Tatum. He said, "Hey, we've been booed before, and they have, and they will again." We all remember the famous Rick Pitino line that about, you know, I remember when Yaz was booed, you know, and all that. And Yaz certainly was booed. And yet I was there in 1983 when he played his final game, and they had that 2-day Yaz celebration and did nothing but cheer him. And in fact, they cheered him the last 4 or 5 years he played. So, you know, booing is in the moment. And I guarantee that every single fan who booed will be, cheering wildly cheering at home if they win tonight, or cheering on Sunday if they win, and certainly be cheering themselves hoarse if they win the NBA championship. you know, and I'm just answering the question here. There'll be a million people at the Rolling Rally, and nobody will be talking about the night they booed after Game 5.
Are they the better team?
Yes. I don't think anybody listening needs my expertise to say that, yes, they're a better team.
Well, we'll see what happens tonight.
I guess I should pose the question to you. Do you think they're a better team?
I think they're a deeper team. I think they can go 8-9 and still have some talent out there. But again, that doesn't matter when you get to the postseason. The best team doesn't always win.
I could also provide a philosophical riddle and say they have better players, but are they a better team? There's a ponderous question for you.
That might be a little too weighty for a Thursday afternoon.
a little too deep.
Steve Buckley of The Athletic with us. Forget the Celtics for the moment and the Bruins. Let's talk about the feel-good story of the spring of 23, those overachieving Red Sox.
You know, I am unqualified to talk about the Reds. I'm kidding. that's my snarky way of saying I haven't been able to watch them a lot. But I've been reading and listening to the talk shows, and I've caught an inning here and there. And I am not saying I told you so or anybody else that I told this to, but I did tell anybody who would listen to me in spring training, hey, they're going to be a better team than we give them credit for.
You said that right here on March 31st. Okay. I went back and listened.
Thank you. And I have questions about starting pitching, but I am always wrong about starting pitching because I'm from an era when you had five guys who rolled out there and they all pitched 200 plus innings, you know, 250 innings. If you want to go back to Mickey Lowell, 300 innings. But my point is they had a whole bunch of guys, I think in 04, so we're not talking 1960 something here. In 04, when they won the World Series, they had five starters combined for 155 starts, I want to say. And I know you're not going to have that anymore in baseball because starters come and starters go and you have openers and all that stuff. But I wish the starting pitching were deeper. But in terms of their entertainment value, they seem to be enjoying each other, which I guess the Celtics could learn a lesson from. And from what I've seen, they're playing exciting baseball. And I think the problem is that a lot of people, they miss the days of stars, you know, Manny and Pedro and Curt and Big Poppy and all that. And even their secondary stars were stars, you know, like Mike Lowe and Euculus and guys like that. Veritek, you know, Veritek had like a .397 on base percentage the year they won the World Series in 04. They don't really have that now. They have more working man type players, more metrics type players, and you know, we'll see who emerges as stars as time goes on. But I think people should embrace the team and the fact that it's playing well.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because I think it was Lou Merlone on one of the broadcasts recently speculated that, you know, maybe with this team, with really just one star in Devers, maybe these other guys as role players feel like they've got a chance to contribute and maybe rise to that star level themselves, and they can't look around and say, well, if I don't come through, Xander will get a hit. JD will take care of it. Now it's just one star on the team and everybody else maybe fighting for that number two spot.
Well, I'm a big Lou Merlone fan, so I can't improve on that, and I agree with that wholeheartedly.
I want to ask you about one of my favorite players from my youth who passed away recently, Vida Blue. Boy, the early 70s, there weren't many better than him. And I know you'll remember this game in 71. I want to say...
I was there!
Oh, Vida Blue versus Sonny Siebert.
Sonny Siebert, I was there. And I am not one of these people who's going to tell you I was at the Bobby Thompson game in 1961. you know, there's an old story. If everyone who says they were at this or that game was actually there, there'd be 300,000 people there. And
right, the Dave Moorhead no-hitter that nobody was at, that so many say they actually saw.
Yeah, 1,200 people. And I wrote a funny column a couple of years ago, if I may say so, that during the pandemic, when the Red Sox played games at an empty Fenway Park, I wrote a column in which I talked to Dave Moorhead about what it's like to pitch in an empty Fenway Park because there were 1,200 people there in 1965 when he threw his no-hitter. So, God, I can't believe I'm bringing Dave Moorhead. I got to tell you a Vita Blue story real quick.
Please do.
And I was with Dan Shaughnessy, my good friend, at the Yogi Berra documentary Monday night in Boston. And we got to talking about Vita Blue. And when I told him his story, he says, oh, my God, have you written that? And I probably will at some point. But do you remember when Joe DiMaggio was a coach with the Oakland A's for a couple of years?
I sure do.
So I was 69 or 70. Well, there came a day when I was with some friends. I was 13 or 14, whether it was 69 or 70, I forget. And DiMaggio comes walking out of Fenway after a game, and we went to an Oakland A's game at Fenway. And, of course, he's a big, tall, handsome guy with a beautiful gray suit. And we followed him all the way up Jersey Street, right on Brookline Avenue, over the Turnpike Bridge, down into Kenmore Square. He took a right and walked into what was then the Somerset Hotel, which is now the Hotel Commonwealth. I swear to God, it's a true story. And none of us had the courage to ask him for an autograph. We walked right into the lobby with him. The elevator door opened. He stepped in. And just as he stepped in and turned around, I said, Mr. DiMaggio, can I have your autograph? And he, as the door was closing, he looked at me and said, take a hike. and the door closed. And all of a sudden, we hear a voice, hey, come here. And there was this young man sitting in a chair about 20 feet away. And he calls us over and he says, what did Mr. DiMaggio say to you? And I said, he said to take a hike. And this young man, who I give away the story, it was Vita Blue, was like 19 or 20 years old, in a nice suit. We ended up talking for 10 minutes. And he says, well, then, if Mr. DiMaggio says you should take a hike, you should take a hike. And I've had that story with me all these years. And he was, you know, we were like 13 or 14. He was like, you know, it's funny because as the years go on, we're basically become the same age. But back then, I think he was seven or eight years older than me. And so that's my Vita Blue story.
I love it. That's great. But that game, that 71 game, and I'll get it wrong, but one of them I think was 9-0, and the other was 10-1.
I thought 9-1, but yeah, you're right. And Peter Gammons, who was covering the Red Sox back then, claims, I don't mean to say he's claiming it, but he's of the opinion that may have been the biggest crowd in Fenway Park history because the fire laws were different. And I have a distinct memory that I've never gotten out of my head that when you looked up to the right field bleachers, you could not see the aisles going up to the top because everybody was sitting in the aisles. And in those days, for you children in our audience, you could get into Fenway for a sellout game just by hand. You would be in line with the fans, and the ticket takers would be there. And instead of handing the guy a ticket, you would hand him a $5 bill rolled up, and he would take the $5, and you just walk right in. And I think with security and cameras and whatnot being what it is now, and the sensors they use to scan your ticket, that practice is long gone. But I submit that on that evening, it was one of those things that everybody got caught up in the moment. It was viewed as a playoff preview, and of course the Sox ended up fading in the second half of the season. But at that moment on that night, everybody wanted to be at Fenway, and my brother and I were there that night. It was, again, I wasn't there for the 67 series. I wasn't there for this. My four games that I remember the most were that game. I was there for games 1 and 2 of the 75 World Series. And probably my biggest memory, I still have the ticket stub, was opening day 1975 for two reasons. It was Tony Conigliaro's second comeback, and he was the Sox DH that day. And the Milwaukee Brewers were in town, and it was Henry Aaron's first game in the American League in Boston. Playing against the Red Sox, and I got to see Henry Aaron and Tony C play. That was a cherished memory of mine.
Wow. I remember one of the first games I saw there was going to see them play the Washington Senators, and Frank Howard, I think...
Biondo?
Yeah. Frank Howard struck out the first three times, and then the fourth time up, I don't think he even swung. I think he just flicked his wrists and put one over the Green Monster and out into the street.
My favorite players as a child were Frank Howard, number one by far, followed by, in no particular order, Harmon Killebrew, Al Kaline, Frank Robinson, Brooks Robinson. Those were the players I really got a kick out of. And years later, I was the beat writer for Tacoma News Tribune of Seattle, covering the Seattle Mariners. And Dick Williams was the manager, and he had Frank Howard on his coaching staff. And I made it a point to get chummy with Hondo. And on more than a few occasions, we went out and had a pop back in my beer drinking days. And he was still is a wonderful, sweet guy. And I told him, I said, "You were my favorite player as a kid," which is sort of like violating that fourth wall as a sports writer. But given that he was no longer a player and I was no longer a kid, I felt comfortable saying that. He was pleased. What a fun player he was.
That's great. Now, I don't have any stories like being told to take a hike by a Hall of Famer. The closest I can come, when I was about 12 or 13, I was standing out by the players' gate hoping to get an autograph and almost got run over by Bob Montgomery driving his sports car out with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
Yeah, I think I may have topped you on celebrity encounters at Fenway Park. Although I should point out, I have a particular fondness for Bob Montgomery because I believe he spent 10 years in the minors before he got a chance to play in the big leagues. And if your listeners want to look up his record, go Bob Montgomery minors, you'll see he basically played all of the 1960s in the minors and basically all of the 1970s in the big leagues. And for him to Wes Gibson was like that, and Gary Wozlewski, and we've all, and there was a guy in the Pirates that got called up a few weeks ago. It's been 13 years in the minors. Mm. I have a special fondness for players who really put in those kind of years. They gutted out for years and years and years just to get a chance to play in the big leagues.
Well, plus Amonte, I think, was the last player to play without a batting helmet.
He was, and in fact, if memory serves, no player had been in the big leagues without a helmet in several years. But what happened was when they put that rule in, they grandfathered any player playing professional baseball could continue not wearing a helmet for the duration of their career. And the rule was put into play in the early 1960s when he was a low-level minor league player. Well, years and years went by before he finally got to the big leagues, and everybody's wearing helmets, and all of a sudden, 28-year-old Bob Montgomery shows up just wearing a cap. I believe he had some kind of, there was a skull plate, but something that went inside the cap.
Right, right.
But he never wore a helmet in the big leagues. And he played until 79, I want to say. And so as late as 1979, which seems preposterous today, there was a player in the big leagues without a helmet.
Steve Buckley of The Athletic with us here on Downtown. Buck, a pleasure as always. Thank you for making some time for us, and we'll catch up with you again soon. And we won't talk Sinatra next time.
I appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Steve Buckley with us.